Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. In the session that was last week, it occurred to me afterwards there was one point I didn't complete, which I had better return to before proceeding with the main topic. When I was giving as one of the proofs that the Declaration of Independence's true author is Thomas Paine, the last and one of the more significant proofs was the existence of the Adams copy of the Declaration of Independence, the Adams copy of the rough draft, or the original draft, rather, before it got mutilated in the committee of the Continental Congress, and the strongest points were chopped out on slavery and so forth. And I made the point that the letters of certain nouns, of many of the more prominent nouns, common nouns, were capitalized. It occurred to me after the lecture was over that I forgot to connect that up as to why that indicates that Paine is the author. I already mentioned why it couldn't be either Jefferson or Adams. This I did cover last session. But what I omitted mentioning is that this clue also, as all the others, points to Thomas Paine, because that was his style. That was his definite style of writing if you look at everything else he ever wrote. He always capitalized prominent common nouns, the ones that were of significance as he saw them in the sentence. And the reason for that is also connected with his Quaker upbringing, which also influenced his writing the word hath, H-A-T-H, the archaic and obsolete form of the word has, which is very prominent in Paine's writings. He used it many, many times, frequently in all of his writings, whereas Jefferson, in something like several millions of published words, never used it once, except when he was quoting someone else, which he was doing here. This usage of hath is part of Paine's Quaker heritage. So is the use of the capitalized letters. This, you see, comes from Old English, and the Quakers are very conservative in changing their styles of not just writing, but mode of dress and mode of communication, and the way they talk, thee and thou, to this day, or at least till more recently than others. I'd like to emphasize that they have a more conservative trend in their mannerisms, and Paine had this in his upbringing. The reason that it was prominent in his writings, as I say, is because of his mode of early education. Old English is related to German, and those of you who know German know that in German all nouns, without exception, are capitalized. All common nouns, not merely proper nouns, but common nouns are capitalized. And Old English was a transition between the more modern English and the Anglo-Saxon tongues, which were Germanic. The transition was that only the more prominent nouns were capitalized. And Paine, as I say, inherited this style. And this is quite characteristic of his style. And as a last point to be made on this single point of the authorship of the Declaration of Independence, it is important to point out that whereas several of the clues completely exclude the possibility that Jefferson could be the author, the slavery clause is a 100% certainty that Jefferson is not the author. And also this business about the capitalized letters and the existence of the Adams copy, which differs from the Jefferson copy. These are all 100% certainties that each of them represents a proof that Jefferson could not be the author. None of these proves that Paine is the author with 100% certainty. But every single clue as to who the true author is has several candidates as to who could possibly be the author. The word hath includes Thomas Paine as a possible candidate for authorship. It would also include, in this case, not Jefferson, but Patrick Henry, among others. The attitude on slavery would include Thomas Paine, would exclude Jefferson, but would also include Samuel Adams, for instance. But the only possible historic figure of the 18th century who fills all the clues without exception is Thomas Paine. And also, although there were a few other people such as Adams who did not believe in slavery, Samuel Adams that is, no one had the vigor and the vehemence on the subject that Paine had. And of course the entire style of the Declaration of Independence practically has his fingerprint on it. He had a very unique style of writing, which probably no one has successfully emulated. Now let's go on with the main topic of the evening, the final session of this short three-session course. Let's analyze, first of all, what the purpose of having this course is in the first place. The first two sessions were mainly confined to the history of the period around the time of the American and French Revolutions and the biographical material that concerns Paine and the connection of Thomas Paine with the Declaration of Independence, the American Revolution, and the general philosophical movement for freedom of the 18th century. So, as you can see, the early two-thirds, the first two-thirds of this course is a historical analysis of what the significance and meaning of the 18th century movement called the American Revolution is. And I think you will agree, without too much effort, that what was given here is not given in the usual analyses or treatments of American history, which I claim are total distortions of what really happened. And I have given you the reasons for this. However, that be that as it may, this is interesting to me, probably, I hope, to you, what the significance of the American Revolution for the 18th century was, and what a correct historical approach to understanding that period is. Although this is interesting in its own right, as a student of history, if any of you consider yourselves such, there is something far more pressing in terms of urgency and importance that this material has to offer for us today, who are living in the 20th century, and for that matter, for those who will succeed us in the 21st and 22nd and so on into the future centuries, because I can maintain even stronger a statement than that. If we don't learn this lesson properly as to what the significance of the American Revolution is, and go on from there and recognize where we can go beyond that and what we can do with it, there may not be a 21st or a 22nd or a 23rd century for the human race. And this I'm saying in complete earnestness without the slightest bit of hesitancy. There is absolutely no question in my mind that we have the most important, most deep, and the supreme crisis of the human race confronting us at this moment. As a matter of fact, in our more advanced courses, especially in our very most advanced course thus far, V201, I emphasize that this is more than a supreme crisis to the human race. This is even one step higher. This is what I call the critical period in the existence of this particular species to which we belong, which is usually called Homo sapiens, but is more accurately described as Homo sap at this moment, and represents an attempt on the part of man to emerge from his period of idiocy, which has preceded our present time in history. Our whole past history is anchored on idiocy and the rule of the irrational and the rule of the immoral. I'm going to back all these things up in a little while. We have reached a stage in the culture that will come to any volitional species, anywhere in the universe, at any time. It's the period of criticality, which determines whether that species lives or dies, whether it dies out totally and becomes extinct. If we don't survive this particular crisis, there shan't be a human race. Why is this so? And why am I bold enough to make such a statement? And why should this not be regarded as just another crackpot comment? And why should you not just relegate this into the same category of doom criers that people have had to contend with since the dawn of time? There have always been people who are claiming that things are going to hell and that this is a heck of a lousy generation and that this is a period of great crisis. What makes this crisis so much different from every other crisis in history? We have had an event occur exactly 301 years ago, which changed the history of the human race. And that event is the integration of the physical sciences into a comprehensive single package of knowledge, which has improved the ability of man to cope with the laws of nature in the physical universe, and also has enabled him to master physical forces beyond any concept of earlier man. The human species at this time is capable, through physical science knowledge, and to a lesser extent through biological science knowledge, of developing technologies and products of technologies which have energy potentials and releases comparable to what takes place in the center of the sun. And we are capable of generating energy densities which equal or exceed the energy densities available in the sun. That is a mighty large amount of energy available to the human species at this time. Now the question is, what do we do with that energy? Do we use it for purposeful and constructive reasons which will improve ourselves, or will we use these energies haphazardly, without thinking, and irrationally? In which case, these same abilities to develop energies of this high order are capable of killing every human being. And if it doesn't happen through such a thing as a blast, you obviously realize I'm referring to nuclear energy, and as a matter of fact, the things which are in the offing, which are even more potent than what are now called hydrogen bombs, these will be sometime in the near future probably as impotent compared with future devices as the firecracker is compared with the hydrogen bomb. Now, when we're getting that smart in technology, in physical technology, it behooves us to learn a little bit about how to behave ourselves, because this is getting to the point where it looks very much as though we were a bunch of infants in a room full of dynamite and then given a couple of boxes of matches to play with, and then wonder what happens. We have got no ability to behave ourselves in such a way that these energies are used for constructive rather than destructive purposes. Why? For one single, solitary, identifiable reason, which is pinpointed as follows. What happened in 1665 and the following year, 1666, which is 301 years ago and 300 years ago respectively, Isaac Newton, as a lone individual, working by himself in solitude with no research team or federal aid to help him, he developed certain ideas which have changed the entire face of the human universe, or the universe accessible to human undertaking. It has changed the destiny of man. It has given us the present world of technology out of which these energy devices have become available to us. No corresponding development occurred in the field of human behavior, human action, volitional experience. Volition, of course, means the ability to choose. And I call a science which has to be developed volitional science. Just as there is a physical science and a biological science, physical science deals with matter and energy on a cosmic scale. Biological science deals with that branch of the physical universe which possesses what is called life. Biologists haven't done quite so well as the physicists yet. They have a somewhat more difficult science. They haven't even properly identified exactly what is meant by life, but we're getting there. I already know what the purpose of life is, by the way, but I got it through physics and not through biology. I got it through the first and second laws of thermodynamics. And the Free Enterprise Institute will offer a course in the hopefully near future on the purpose of life, which is developed from physical science. Subtitle of that course would be Capitalism from a Cosmic Point of View. If anybody thinks that capitalism is merely an economic subject, disabuse your minds of the subject, because it isn't true. Capitalism is a universal concept which deals with their behavior of volitional beings, which brings me to the third subject. The first was physics, the second was biology, and the third is volition. Volition is the act of choosing. Those biological organisms which are capable of exercising choice or volition are capable of making distinctions between various courses of action and deciding which of numerous alternatives to follow. This is not true, for example, of a stone. Once you know what forces are acting on a stone, you know exactly what's going to happen to it. Once you know its initial position, its initial velocity, and the forces acting on it, you can predict where that stone will be at all future times. That is something you cannot do with a human being. If you know what motivational influences are acting on a human being, you don't know how he will react to them. You can put a man under a given set of conditions, state what the conditions are, and you don't know what he will do, which of the many courses available to him he will choose. If you don't believe me, let me ask you a simple question. Where do you expect to be on April 22nd, 4:30 p.m., 1978? Is there anyone here who thinks he can answer that intelligently and predictably? Obviously not. I could ask you this an hour before it happens. I could ask you right now, where will you be an hour from now? And you won't know. There will be exceedingly large probability you'll still be here. But it's not a certainty. There may be any number of things that could happen. For example, a hydrogen bomb may drop on us and our atoms might be scattered. Or you might get sick either of the lecture or physically and walk out. Or I might drop dead. I don't expect to. I don't plan it that way. But these are all things that could happen. So the point is that every human act is capable of being altered, not only by external influences which are not predictable, but even internally, the individual cannot predict his own future actions with certainty. This makes for a very difficult science, but difficult does not mean impossible. There's a very strong technical distinction between impossible and difficult. What is this distinction? Most people don't observe this distinction, and most people say impossible when they don't mean it. And I would like to admonish you and warn you that never use the word impossible unless you are absolutely certain that it is a meaningful statement and that you really can back it up. Otherwise, what you say is impossible might make you look very foolish a little later. For example, if you were to have a canvas of the population in the year 1900 and ask people, tell me, do you believe that man can fly and that man shall be flying? The average person in 1900 would have certainly said, no, man cannot fly. And quite a large number, I don't know how large, but I would venture to say, judging from my experience with knowing people even in the present era, most people, or at least many people, would have gladly volunteered, oh no, man cannot fly, that's impossible, you know. And if you were to pin them down and say, why is it impossible for man to fly, their only reason would be one of perhaps two variations of essentially the same reason. Either it would be something like this. Many men have tried to fly over the past ages. Man has dreamed about flying for thousands of years. And some people have tried it. Some have written about it. Some have actually tried it. And it didn't work. And if after all these thousands of years no one has ever learned how to fly, then surely it must be impossible. Or a variation of this would be, I don't know how to fly. And then unspoken would be implied, of course, I'm the smartest person in the world, and if I don't know how to fly, obviously the other boobs can't either. The form of this argument essentially is that a person considers that to be impossible, which he doesn't know how to solve. On that basis, I wish to emphasize that you can get into a lot of embarrassment at later times, because obviously anyone who would have said in 1900, it's impossible for man to fly, he would have become converted into a monkey in 3 years, because the Wright brothers would have made a monkey out of him. They flew in 1903, and since then millions of other people have flown. In the same way that Wilbur and Orville Wright did fly in 1903, other people could have flown in 1900, but they didn't. Now let's analyze why not. They didn't fly for a very simple reason. They didn't know how. Now we're getting to the point. There's a difference between not knowing how to do something and calling it impossible. Once you learn how, then you have educated yourself to the point where you're capable of mastering forces or mastering natural principles which will enable you to develop forces which will make it possible to do what earlier people couldn't do, or more accurately, didn't do because they didn't know how. The situation then is as follows. In 1900, it could have been said properly that it is difficult to fly, but not that it is impossible. That means that it is not known and it is requiring a certain amount of effort to develop the knowledge to know how to fly. On that basis, we have an improvement factor available. Difficulty can be reduced to simplicity. Today, it is not proper for man to say it is difficult to fly. In 1900, it would have been proper for man to say it is difficult to fly because at that time they didn't know how. No one did yet. The Wright brothers were already trying and learning, but they didn't quite master the job yet. Today, it is not proper to say it is difficult to fly. It is more proper to say it's very simple to fly. Anyone can do it. All you have to do is buy a ticket. Anyone in the world can fly today. The stupidest person in the world can fly today. He just hires someone to take him up. The point is, it has become easy because the technology for it has become widespread, and today there are many people who know how to design airplanes. Not just two, Wilbur and Orville Wright, but there are thousands of people who know how to design airplanes, and probably several million who know how to fly them, which isn't the same as knowing how to build them. And then anyone who cannot either build them or fly them can hire someone to do it for him, and then anyone can fly, even if they don't know how to build them, the airplanes, and if they don't know how to fly them. They can hire someone to do this. And so consequently, it has become very simple. It has never been impossible to fly. Does this mean that I have just ruled out the concept of impossibility and that nothing is really impossible? It's merely waiting until we learn how to do something? No. There is such a thing as impossible. And it's very important to recognize this, that there are things which are impossible, and there are things which are not impossible, but which are simply difficult, which can then phase into easy later. The things which are impossible, which will never be done, are things which are involving actions which require a violation of natural principles or natural laws. It is not possible to develop something which is operating contrary to natural law. It is not possible, for example, to develop a perpetual motion machine. As a matter of fact, in physics, three different kinds of perpetual machine have been intellectually devised. None of them have ever been built to operate. Models have been built, and they've failed. And they will always fail. Now, that's a pretty bold statement, and I don't hesitate to make it, and I don't worry that in 2 years, some new Wright Brothers type will come along and make a monkey out of me. I'm not worried that 2 or 3 years from now somebody will build a perpetual motion machine, or that in 300 years someone will do it, or in 3,000 years, or in 3 million years. That's quite a long time ahead, and I'm going quite a bit out on a limb. But I don't think that there will ever be a perpetual motion machine for a very good reason. We are in possession of knowledge today which involves a comprehension of the physical universe which we call laws of nature, which I might add are man-made. And I don't wish to go into that in great detail, because that would take us far afield from this course's material. But natural laws are man-made laws in the sense that man discovers them. There are no natural laws except in the minds of volitional beings, and those are contrived by those minds. But the question is, do those minds comprehend natural principles so that there's a one-to-one correspondence between events as they occur, and events as they're predicted? And if you have a working experience which is long enough and consistent enough to justify the prediction, you venture forth, you go out on a limb and say, this is an eternal, universal law of nature. And that is man's opinion that this is the way the universe is built. Our present conception of the universe involves various kinds of understandings or comprehensions of various forms of natural phenomena. Among these are, for example, the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Perpetual motion machine of the first kind is one that would violate the first law of thermodynamics, or otherwise known as the conservation of energy. Second kind of perpetual motion machine would violate the second law of thermodynamics. There's also a third kind, which would be a frictionless device. All three of these would involve a violation of a natural law, and we can safely predict that there will never be a perpetual motion machine. The only possibility of this statement being an error, and I'm taking that risk, is that our comprehension of the laws of nature are inadequate, and what is now called the first law of thermodynamics or the second law of thermodynamics will not be later regarded as correct or valid and will be discarded. In that case, then there could be perpetual motion machines, but we have sufficient evidence to take this extremely strong and uncompromised position on the laws of thermodynamics. Now, why was all this necessary, all this discussion? And what has this got to do with Thomas Paine and the American Revolution and freedom? It has everything to do with it. Because I said the reason we have this supreme crisis is because our physical science has gone ahead, forged ahead so far that we are divergent in our respective capabilities. We have extremely large capabilities to organize the energies available in the physical universe and put them at our own disposal. And we are very much under-knowledged on the other subject of what to do with this ability. We have the ability to harness the energies available in nature and we don't have the ability to harness our own actions, so we don't put these energies to destructive use, which means we don't use them to commit species suicide. Now, why has this not been done? This is the relevancy of the difficult versus impossible argument. Is it because it is impossible to develop evolutional science wherein you can develop comprehension of how human beings ought to behave and how they can act so that they don't destroy each other? Or is it because it's only difficult and we haven't learned how yet? Is it impossible or is it difficult? And upon that, the answer to that question hinges the fate of man. Because if it is impossible to develop evolutional science, then my prediction is man's remaining period in existence as a species is less than a century more to go. That's a pretty horrendous thought, and I hope it upsets your sleep for a few days. I really mean that. Not because I'm wishing you hard luck, but I'd like to interfere with your sleep for the next few days so that you can have a more comfortable sleep and a more likely ability to exist in 30 or 50 years. It would be a good investment of your time to worry about it now to see what can be done about it. Is it impossible to develop evolutional science? If the answer to this is yes, it is impossible, then man has no way of developing knowledge which is capable of remedial action so that he can personally use these tremendous physical energies constructively instead of destructively. Then he will always act haphazardly, and always people who are not competent to understand principles will ultimately get control of these energies and use them for destructive purposes. If, on the other hand, it's only difficult, then we've got a real chance. Because if it's only difficult and not impossible, well, then that means if we learn how, and pretty soon we'll be on top of the world. Because when it becomes important to us to find out how to solve a difficult but very critical and crucial problem, then we will learn how to overcome the problems that are besetting us, surmount the crisis, survive, and win, and have a solution. And later on, what is now called difficult will become so childish that children will be growing up and grade school be learning these principles that now PhDs don't understand. That's not unusual, by the way. I can cite you a simple argument to which a 5-year-old could answer correctly. Any normal child over the age of 5, and some even younger, they'll correctly answer these questions. Tell me, Sonny, is it possible to eat a loaf of bread that has never been baked? You suppose any normal child would not recognize that the answer to that is it is not possible to eat something, a loaf of bread that has never been baked. Tell me, my boy, is it possible to ride in an automobile that has never been built? Can you live in a house that has never been built? Can you wear a suit of clothes that has never been made? Then generalize it. Can you consume something that has never been produced? The answer to these questions is uniformly negative. No, it is not possible to consume anything that has not been produced. Is there anyone here who thinks that any child could not answer that question? Yet, the PhD economists who are running this country's economy don't understand this. The President of the United States does not understand this, and I'm not referring to any particular president. I don't wish to have any partisan arguments here. This has nothing to do with the incumbent president. The present one doesn't know it. The previous one didn't know the answer. The one before that didn't know the answer, nor the one before that, nor the one before that, and so on. So I think you have to go back probably to Grover Cleveland or maybe McKinley before they might have a smattering of an idea that the answer is no. You can't consume something that hasn't been produced. And even they would be a little fuzzy on it. Now you say this is ridiculous. Of course they would know that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you may say that obviously I am foolish and that anybody, a PhD in economics included, a politician included, would know that the answer to that is no. But not in a formal question, probably, yes. If you put it to them as simply as that, they probably would say, no, you can't eat something that hasn't been produced. But the way they operate their policies, the way they run the country, the way they make the decisions that affects your life, your property, your liberty, your actions, everything about your life is decided by people who act as though the answer to these questions were yes. It is possible to consume something which has never been produced. They are talking about distributing wealth that doesn't exist. They're talking about paying for things without first producing the requisite materials or requisite wealth that are necessary to make the purchases. They're talking about feeding the world with no one working. Everybody should work less, be paid more. Ultimately, they want a work week of 0 hours with a minimum wage of $1,000 an hour and nobody doing any work. This is ultimately what this is heading towards. This is impossible. That's not difficult. That's impossible. The point is that we have the ability to develop a volitional science. I'll go farther. It exists now. It doesn't have to be developed. It exists at this moment, except it is not widely known. The purpose of the Free Enterprise Institute, which is the organization that is putting this course before you, is to disseminate this knowledge while there is time to disseminate it and while you can still hope to survive. The main course of this institute, the basic course I should say, is numbered V50. And that one, which is a much longer course than this, V50 develops this science of volition, and it shows where it leads. It shows the kind of world you can build which will be capable of surmounting the crisis that I'm going to talk about for part of this evening. It also shows not only what the kind of world is, or what the kind of world will be, rather, that will emerge, but more importantly, or let's say equally importantly, it shows how to get from here to there. How do we transform our present position of near collapse as a social structure, of near termination as a species, into one that is capable not only of temporary, but of permanent survival? Since I'm predicting and working towards the state, or rather the condition of man, wherein when he survives the present critical stage or supreme crisis, that he will be capable of surviving as a species, not until the next war or the next generation or the next century, but forever. Or for the human species to survive as long as the physical universe is capable of supporting volitional beings. Man does not have to have continuing, recurring, predictable crises which have happened in all past civilizations, and all past civilizations have ultimately collapsed, but none of these were fatal to the species. The previous collapses of civilization only resulted in that particular culture or civilization disintegrating. And then in the same geographical location where that culture once existed, well, there were still people there, except that there was a reduced capability of producing, destitution. People were dying of hunger, malnutrition. There were epidemics. They were subject to looting. There was anarchy or internal small-scale violence, wherein everyone was plundering everyone else, a situation of unpredictable looting on a small scale rather than on a large scale from a major state. And then in the ruins of this previous civilization, ultimately some strong fellow, some big strong-armed man would come along and say, "Now look here, you people are in a bad mess here, and you just trust to me. I'm pretty smart and I'm pretty strong. You just leave it to me, and I'll see to it that nobody will start bothering you, and we will have law and order here. All you have to do is to do as I say. Trust me, follow me, and of course you have to help me support myself. I'm too busy to work. I haven't got time to grow food. I haven't got time to make clothing. I haven't got time to build houses. I'm busy protecting you. And so you have to give me some of what you make, and then I'll see to it that you'll be well off. Entrance, the new king, or tribal chief, duke, prince, count, baron. If he's strong enough, he calls himself king. So I've already pointed out, these are all the same thing, duke, king, and emperor. It's just simply a duke is a little king who hasn't got much confidence in his ability to command. And when he gets to be real tough, he calls himself king. And when he gets really tough, he calls himself emperor. But these are all the same type of generic concept. They're all the same. These are monarchs, single rulers. They command, others obey. In exchange, he provides them protection, or at least that's what he claims. And so long as they believe him, everything is fine and hunky-dory. This is the situation of the human race for thousands of years of recorded history, plus many, many thousands of years more of unrecorded history before we have formal records. This is undoubtedly, as we can learn from archaeological and anthropological findings, the way earlier people
ran their lives. They were simply following leaders. In a more lengthy exposure to these ideas, I would go on and demonstrate that the leaders are really the followers, but I don't think I'd better go into that here. Now, for these many thousands of years, many cultures arose in many parts of the world, and they ultimately all successively disintegrated. And wherever these cultures disintegrated, on the ruins of past civilizations, new ones would arise, patterned on the same fallacies, the same leadership concepts. There was no improvement. The next culture would, the new strong-armed man would build himself up, and a new society would emerge there, a new culture would arise, and then after a while, the commands would get too oppressive to the point where people stopped working, and a new round of destitution and collapse occurred. And these were the many crises. All of these rulers always needed a crisis to keep themselves in power. Because after all, remember, if there was no crisis afoot, after a while these people, you know, after they're no longer being harassed by their neighbors and they're no longer having to get into scuffles with everybody that comes along because the king or the baron or whoever he happens to be has kept law and order in the neighborhood, after a while he says, yeah, it's nice and peaceful now. All I have to do is fork over part of what I make every year to this fellow and keeps it nice and peaceful. As a matter of fact, after a while, people take it for granted. And I say, gee, maybe we don't need this fellow after all. It's so nice and peaceful and quiet now. And so, therefore, the king or the baron cannot afford this harmony and peace. To make sure that no one ever loses track of the fact that he's necessary to be there as ruler, as chief, tribal chief is a good way of referring to him, because you see that tribal chief is associated with a primitive culture, and that's exactly what I'm trying to convey, that this is a primitive mode of social organization. And under these circumstances, the tribal chief, which is the generic name I will use for dukes and barons and kings and emperors, the tribal chief, after a while, has to stir up some trouble and provoke some problems. Because if there weren't a war going on or some other major crisis, at least a riot. He has to have at least a riot going on so he can quell that. Something has to happen, which is a violent nature, so he can show that he's still important to keep the peace, preserve law and order. And so consequently, crisismanship is a way of life. You have to generate crises to make sure that the tribal chief is appreciated. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's the way man lived always for thousands and thousands of years. Except now, something new has happened, and I already mentioned what it is. We now have a physical science which has completely gone beyond the bounds of earlier men. Thanks to the efforts of Isaac Newton, his predecessors who prepared the groundwork for what he did, and all the scientists who came after him, we now have the physical technology available to us to eliminate the entire human species if we misapply these energies. Now, earlier cultures were not beset with this problem. The worst that could happen when a tribal chief started some kind of a skirmish to show how important he was, well, they'd get into a little war, a couple of thousand people would kill each other, and of course it's very catastrophic for those individuals who got killed. To them, the world had come to an end. Any individual who got killed, to him, his world ended. But to the species, looking at it from the standpoint of the entire human race, well, all right, so a few hundred, few thousand, few tens of thousands of people were dead. The rest of them survived with spears and bows and arrows, or even with muskets and cannons. You can't wipe out the human race. I think this is almost certain. Anyhow, no tribal chief ever got us even close to disaster on a species basis, just on an individual basis. But now, with one bomb, you're going to wipe out millions of people. You can put it quite accurately this way. The only thing that stands between death and life for you and me, perhaps, is a bottle of vodka or an American bottle of gin. And the wrong guy drinks the wrong bottle at the wrong time and pushes the wrong button, and that's it. We have other crises, too. I don't wish to say that the only crisis we have is the physical crisis involving physical science destruction. We have some very refined techniques of biological destruction these days, too. Bacteriological weapons, nerve gases. We also have exceedingly refined financial devices to ruin the economy of a nation on a scale unheard of before. In the old days, inflation meant clipping coins. You know why coins have a serrated edge? Why they have those grooves on the edges of coins? So in the old days, people wouldn't go around filing off the edges of the coins and making little piles of gold dust or silver dust and then cheating the state, as the state would like to put it. That would be inflationary. So they worried about a few grams of metal in those days. I call that inflation. We print tons of paper these days. The printing press makes this obsolete. I don't even know why they bother serrating the useless coins that we've got today. They're not even silver anymore. They go through the same image developments. You've seen these phony quarters that have come out in the last year, haven't you? These counterfeit quarters. I don't know. And here's one. Well, it's still a serrated edge, but it wouldn't be worth your trouble to file it off. The physical effort it would take you to file off the metal wouldn't compensate you for the energy you would put out. You can earn a living much better by getting a job of filling grocery bags at a supermarket. It pays better than filing off these coins. The point is, today we have better forms of inflation. We use a printing press. Gutenberg, who was quite a smart fellow, he invented a printing press, which has now been misapplied for financial destruction purposes. And as a matter of fact, that's too slow. That had to suffice for the German inflation of 1923 and the other inflations of Europe and Asia in the after World War I and also after World War II. Today we have even better ways of inflating the currency. We just invent money. Literally. You know how inflation is carried on today? The state wants to pay a bill of so many billions of dollars for some boondoggle they invent. And they say to a bank, not a bank, to the all the organizations that are called banks, as a group. They're commanded by a piece of legislation called the Federal Reserve Act. And they're commanded to open bank accounts for the state. Just open an account. Now, how do you open a bank account, ladies and gentlemen? You have to work and earn some money, and then you have to deposit the money, and then the bank will open an account for you. Is this correct? How does the state open a bank account? It just tells the bank, open a bank account for us, and here's the security. I'll give you another piece of paper. I owe you from the federal state. It's called a bond. So they print a piece of paper, one piece of paper, not millions of tons of paper, say $1 each. They print some big pieces of paper, $10 million bonds or something like that. That's a $10 million bank account. Collateral? Empty hogwash. A promise to pay. From where? From nowhere. They don't have it. Someday they figure they'll steal enough from you in taxes to pay it back. But it never works out that way because they have more projects. And they invent the projects faster than they can tax you. So that's why they have to invent money like this. Incidentally, they do this with your money too. When you borrow money from a bank, when you personally borrow money from a bank, do you think they're lending you money? They just created it on empty paper. There's nothing behind it. Absolutely nothing. They just issue you a credit account with nothing behind it. Well, I don't want to go into this because that would go take us far afield, and I don't want to give a whole lecture on this fiasco, financial fiasco. I just want to point out that the national debt structure of this country is so fantastic that you wouldn't believe it if I told you. So I'll tell you just a few hints. You know what the federal national debt is at this time? It claimed to be around $300 billion, give or take a few tens of billions, I forgot. I've been looking in the newspaper the last few weeks, and therefore I don't remember how many tens of billions it has fluctuated. That's what they claim is the national debt. That's actually a fraud because they don't want to tell you how much it really is. It's over $1 trillion. They have various concealed forms of debt like Social Security, trust funds which are not solvent, and therefore they have contingent liabilities which are unfunded, and any insurance company that would operate on that basis, the management would go to jail for grand larceny and misrepresentation of the public to the public. But, they have a few hundred billions of dollars there. In addition to the formal national debt, and then they have Railroad Retirement Act and civil service pensions and military pensions, and road building trust funds. I like the word trust in all this. When you add all this up, it comes to way over $1 trillion. That's what the federal national debt is. Add to this what the county debts are, the city debts, the municipal water districts, the metropolitan water districts, the bridge authorities, tunnel authorities, and of course the 50 local states, you know, the Alabama through Wyoming. All of these states have debts, and so added up, and it comes to somewhere between $2.5 and $3 trillion, give or take a few hundred billion. I mean, that's how ridiculous it has got. Now you say, well, these are just numbers. Do you know how big a trillion is? Is there anybody in this room who has the slightest comprehension of what a trillion is? Let me give you a slight idea. This is really not going to do it for you, but just to give you an order of magnitude. A trillion is 1,000 billion. And you know what a billion is? That's easier to handle. How long would it take you to earn $1 billion if you earned a dollar a second? That's a little higher pay than I think most of you are accustomed to making. That's a little bit higher than the minimum wage even. If you earned $1 a second, you would earn $60 a minute. I think you could comfortably live on that. You would earn $3,600 an hour. You would earn $86,400 a day. You would earn $1 million in about 12 days. Now, assuming you earned at that rate, a dollar a second, every day of your life, from the moment you were born, most embryos and most infants don't earn money, but assuming from the moment you were born, you earned at the rate of a dollar a second, while you slept, while you ate, while you went to the movies, while you were bowling, while you were attending courses, while you were doing anything else, you're earning a dollar a second. You'd have to be a third of a century old before you had $1 billion at that rate. And you need 1,000 of those to have a trillion. Well, I don't think that conveys the idea too well, but it's better than nothing at all. Anyhow, it's an amount of money that the bureaucrats and the politicians cannot fathom. Because it takes even an astronomer, a mathematician, and a physicist a long time to ponder the size of those numbers, and these people are used to it. I'm an astrophysicist by profession, but I can't afford the present world its extravagance, so I have to convert my efforts to something to make it possible for astrophysicists to exist next century, too. You might say I'm trying to make the world safe for astrophysicists. The point is that you have no concept of the magnitude of this debt. The annual interest on this national debt, that's the formal part of the national debt, that's the part that's acknowledged, about $300 billion. That's only about 10% of the real debt. The interest on that alone is about three times as high every year. The interest on it is three times as high as the entire national budget, federal national budget in 1929, which is just one generation ago. That's in the 20th century, you know. We're not talking about ancient Rome. We're not even talking about Washington's America. We're talking about the 20th century. The annual interest on the present formal part of the national debt is three times larger than the entire federal expenditure just one generation ago. At this rate, you don't need a hydrogen bomb, nerve gases, or bacteriological warfare to wipe out the human race. We can economically destroy a nation internally. Now, all of this type of catastrophe emerged out of only one thing. That you don't have to look for 1,000 different causes. It all came out of one single cause. Our inability to match volitional knowledge, knowledge about volitional science and applications to human practice or technology, to match this with our abilities in physics and biology. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in the 18th century, there was a minor, I'm afraid I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but I have to put it this way. There was a minor attempt to do this, to develop a volitional science. This is called the American Revolution. And that's the relevance of the earlier two sessions of this course to what I've been driving up to in this third session. What is now called the American Revolution in history, the real significance of it is that Thomas Paine, the central figure of the American Revolution, was attempting to develop a rational structure for human existence. When I say minor, I should actually explain that. It is not minor in importance, it is minor in success. The American Revolution did not succeed in being permanent. However, the principles developed there were of stupendous importance, and the fact that this was the first attempt in the entire history of the human species to have a rational picture of human behavior, an attempt to form a social structure patterned on natural law, this is the real significance of the American Revolution, which will transcend the 18th century and which makes the discussion of the past two sessions on the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Paine more than of passing historical significance. The Declaration of Independence is not just another document. Thomas Paine is not just another historical figure. Thomas Paine was the most successful and most competent technologist of the 18th century in attempting to develop a science and technology of human behavior based upon the Newtonian principles of the century before. The same Newton that made it possible to develop a physical science of such tremendous potential as has changed the entire face of the earth and the whole lot and destiny of man, that same integration of knowledge in the physical sciences can be duplicated in the volitional domain, which is admittedly more difficult because it is a field where you cannot predict future events as simply as in physics. As I said, you can tell where a stone will be if you specify its present position, its present velocity, and the forces acting on it at all times. You can predict where it's going to be. With human beings, rather volitional beings, you cannot make equally certain predictions. Despite this immense handicap, it is possible to develop a science of volition. What does that mean? What is a science anyhow? A science is organized knowledge. It is the ability of man to make predictions which are capable of being corroborated by observation. Despite the uncertainties of volition, it is nevertheless possible to develop a science here, and this is what is taught in course B50. That is the subject of that course. It is the development of the science of volition and demonstrating how it can lead to a different kind of a world wherein human beings are capable of harnessing the forces and energies of nature to their benefit and not to their detriment. And where there is no possibility of this being abused, misused, and leading to species suicide. That is the concept of volitional science. It was not developed in the 18th century, but there was an attempt to do so by a rather large number of illustrious thinkers, of whom Paine was one, not the only one by any means. But he was the one who reduced it to practice. There were many in the chain between Isaac Newton at the one end and Thomas Paine at the other end. Isaac Newton was the integrator of knowledge in physics. He did not develop anything in the volitional domain, to my knowledge. At least he disclosed nothing. But his immediate friend, John Locke, did. And from John Locke on, and also an independent channel through Baruch Spinoza in continental Europe, two streams of liberal thinking developed. I better explain the word liberal here, because I know that this word is abused in the present vocabulary, and it is useful to point out that I do not mean by this word what is used in contemporary usage, applying the word liberal to all kinds of statist activities and state handout programs and state coercive programs. The word liberal comes from the word liber in Latin, which means free. And liberal is an adjective, means pertains to free, or pertaining to freedom more loosely. And as a matter of fact, I would suggest that you might read something that I wrote some time ago. I might as well read that into the course, since it pertains to what's in course V76. Why does an individual who practices and promotes capitalism call himself liberal? Because the word liberal originally came into popular use to describe the ideological content of the American Revolution. CCI, which is an abbreviation I use to stand for Constitutionalism, Capitalism, Individualism. Liberal means liber equals free plus al, A-L, equals pertaining to, hence pertaining to free or pertaining to freedom. Liberal produces a favorable image in the minds of most people. Whoever wears the hat of liberalism has the scales tipped in his favor. Today, the anti-liberal socialists wear this hat. Is it any wonder they are popular and winning? The founders of this republic established a capitalistic nation. They are rightfully called liberals. Historically, that's what the word liberal was coined for in the English language. It's a contrived word based upon a Latin root. It came into usage in the 19th century, and it was originally coined to describe the movement that occurred in the American Revolution as a liberating one from human oppression. By calling ourselves liberals, we reestablish our ideological kinship with these great men and do not let this advantage accrue to the socialists. Recovery of this word for freedom is a worthy goal and a major weapon against socialist ideas. If you value your freedom and survival and realize their dependence upon CCI, then join with us in calling yourself a liberal. Regain the rightful ownership of the word regain your lost reputation and intellectual ancestry. The word belongs to you and not to the socialists. True liberalism is capitalism. Capitalism is the key to survival. This is a one-sheet publication called Thrust for Freedom Number 1. There are five others published in this series at this time, rather four others. The other four are on property, freedom, capitalism, and progressive. And there are actually 12 written, but only so far five have been published. The 12 will be published as a booklet. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the American Revolution, which is the subject of this course, is a genuine, bona fide revolution. It's a turning around of human structure from a position of slavery to a different kind of structure. It did not make the complete turn, but it was a start in this direction. A total revolution is a turning around of man from a position of enslavement to a position of freedom. It cannot be done by violence. It cannot be done by overthrowing a tyrant. It cannot be done by agitation against this or that politician, this or that party, or this or that social structure. It cannot be done at all by fighting against anything. It can only be done by the achievement of a comprehension of the laws of nature and how they pertain to human volitional behavior. And when you know how to act, then those who don't know how to act will not be capable of exercising any control over you. Why? Because those who are rational are superior in their potential to those who are irrational. I am aware of the fact that I have not defined in this course the word rational, and I apologize to you for this because this is beyond the scope of a short course. It takes several hours to identify the concept of rationality precisely and accurately. This is done in V50 at the very early part of the course. Those of you who have not taken our main course, I'm pointing out that what the American Revolution represents is, in fact, a historical initial attempt to create a volitional science. It did not make it all the way, but it has two significant and lasting values. Number one, a great discovery was made in the latter part of the 17th and all through the 18th and even through the early part of the 19th century, a cumulative great discovery, and that is, man can develop rationality in human behavior. They didn't fully learn how, but the mere identification of this possibility, the transformation of the concept of impossible to difficult, the fact that it was recognized that this could be done if we try, this is a great achievement. This is to the everlasting, eternal credit of all those that succeeded Isaac Newton in this great achievement. John Locke, Spinoza was a contemporary of Newton rather than a successor, and the many disciples of these two streams of thought, Spinoza and John Locke. They include, among others, the great French philosopher Voltaire, who was a great Newtonian. I might add, every 18th century libertarian, or let's be more precise, liberal, and I'm using this word in the correct sense, to eliminate state tyranny. That's the correct, original, and permanent meaning of the word, not to be confused with the current political distortions. Every 18th century liberal was a disciple of Isaac Newton. Not one of these people who added to the stream of events in America, in England, and in France. These are the three bulwarks of freedom. These are the three countries in which it developed. Not one of the great thinkers who are associated with 18th century liberalism was ignorant of Isaac Newton's achievement. And every last one of them was either a scientist, such as Benjamin Franklin. I've already pointed out, if he hadn't been involved in the political episodes of the American historical era at that time, then he would be remembered even better as a physicist. It is true of the lesser figures, such as Jefferson and Madison. It is true of the great Voltaire, whom I just mentioned, who was actually acquainted with Newton, I believe personally, and certainly his philosophy. He spent time in England. I think he met Newton. I know that he understood Newton. He translated and popularized Newton into French. The French physiocrats, who are the antecedents of what are now called the laissez-faire capitalist philosophers. As a matter of fact, the expression laissez-faire originated in France. Obviously, it's a French term. And it was coined by the physiocrats. And what did that mean? Let alone. And where did it come from? It was an answer to a question. What can the King of France do to make things better for the people of France? And the answer was, leave him alone. Or less politely, but even more bluntly, butt out. Butt out of their lives. Leave them alone. The state should abdicate and get out of the picture of annoying people. Let them live their lives and leave them alone. And this has been denounced today by collectivists and socialists of various ilks as a terrible philosophy. Well, it happens to have been the first step along a very big, very long road to freedom. All of the people of the 18th century that developed it, whether in England, whether in France, or whether in America, who developed freedom in any sense, were disciples of Isaac Newton, and this was the age of rationality, or as Paine called it, the age of reason, the age of enlightenment, the belief that natural law governs the universe and governs man. Let me read you again the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence, and let me show you how this flavors the entire spirit of it. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, etc., etc. The whole thing is anchored on the principle of natural law. The formation of the United States as a nation, as a separate country, was patterned on the concept that it is possible to structure a nation on principles of natural law rather than coercive hand-me-downs from a tribal chief. The great revolution that occurred in America was the achievement of one man, Thomas Paine, who better than any person in America understood Isaac Newton's work. I already pointed out, as a non-incidental biographical reference to Paine's life, his greatest strength was not in the study of the classics of Latin or Greek or of history, as many of the other cultured individuals of that period were well acquainted with Latin, Greek, history, and so forth. That was actually his weakest area. His strongest area was physics, mathematics, and astronomy. When he wasn't busy with the American and later the French revolutions, he was building bridges, and he did other things too. He is the inventor of the modern iron bridge. That in itself would entitle him to immortality in the annals of human memory. Anytime you step on or drive on a metal bridge, you are on a descendant, an intellectual descendant of Thomas Paine's achievement. Who knows this? Who today has even bothered to remember this? He invented, among other things, smokeless candles. That's very little importance today because we don't use candles. We have a higher technology. But you leave it to the state. You better get some candles. You know, you've heard of these blackouts. And with the state running the show, you might carry some candles. Not to go backward, but to prevent you from being totally submerged in darkness. He wrote an essay investigating the cause of yellow fever. In the light of present biological and medical knowledge, his answer doesn't turn out to be right. But he, at least a century before anyone else bothered, tried to find a cause for yellow fever. When it was just a black mystery to other people, he was already thinking about it. He was consulted by Fitch, and I believe also by Fulton, on the steamboat. He almost invented one himself, but he got busy with France, and that distracted his attention. Whereas Fitch and Fulton had no ambitions to straighten out the world in Europe, so they had more time to devote to the steamboat. Otherwise, you might remember Paine as the inventor of the steamboat, since he was also working on it. And they, at least Fitch and I believe also Fulton consulted with him. And they almost went into partnership, I believe, with Fitch. He also, to show you how characteristic his scientific mind was, he once invented, on paper that is, he didn't have time to build it, but he invented, by writing down the specifications for an engine which operates on gunpowder. And he gave us his reason for this, that God must have given man the ability to make gunpowder for a better use than to murder human beings with. And that's characteristic of Thomas Paine. He was always trying to find useful, productive things to do and convert man from a destructive to a constructive being. And so he wanted to find a constructive use for gunpowder, and the actual engine he described probably would work, although we have better engines today, but it was sort of a composite between a reaction turbine and a rocket. And it was quite an interesting development. It's among his scientific papers. The point I'm making is, here's a man whose whole life was anchored on rational thinking. That is the source of it, the knowledge of physical science. I can go farther. I don't know of any single major development in the history of freedom, even after the 18th century, that has occurred through people who knew nothing about physical science. Because without understanding natural law, you won't get anywhere. The only people who have ever developed anything of any value which adds to human knowledge are those people who first mastered a comprehension of the physical universe they live in, because after all, we're volitional beings and we're part of the physical universe. We're not independent of it. We are somewhat different from stones in that we can choose, but that doesn't mean that we still don't have atoms and molecules in our bodies, and we still have to live in a physical universe, which means that we are in and under laws of nature, and the only time we can hope to survive is if and when we comprehend the principles of the universe. And if we go against these principles, we can only expect destruction. Please note that no great invention or discovery has ever been made in the history of the world by a man whose principal occupation was leading soldiers into battle or ruling people like kings. What king ever invented a machine, an engine? They merely use them after someone else has developed them. And then they enslave everyone with the device that is now at their disposal, including the inventor.
Session 3 continues on Disc 7.